This is our highs and highs and hills. Three's Company 2. Come and dance.
Wow, Three's Company starts us off today with our good old-fashioned Talking Comics episode. We got Mo in one corner, usual co-host.
I'm here. Brett's here. First off, we have three guests. That's why we're Three's Company. And I just want to say first off, welcome back to the Long Box Graveyard, Paul O'Connor. Thank you for being on. And I'm already willing to say to you, I'm sorry for getting you into this.
Oh, I'm so happy to be back with you guys. It's been too long.
I don't believe him. That was total baloney.
All right, that was Mr. Anima Bag Jones or Comics Jack Tripper, Scott Kowalczuk.
Yeah, that's me.
Wait, I'll get theme music? Is that what we're doing then?
No, that's what I do.
Yeah, that's...
Well, hang on, can give you theme music if you want.
Then I have theme music then.
Riley, yeah. You want theme music?
Yeah, I have it. I have it ready even.
Oh, wonderful. Paul, we're going to go back to you.
I don't know how to fade it out. Your theme music. Though, so.
Just
push the volume.
Only 6 feet, but I ball like I'm 6'2". Spray paint with shit that graffiti don't stick to. I'm on the grind cause my hustle is official.
Can't wait for it.
The house, you could call my clip the igloo. I'm too legit to describe to you with other rhymes, but they stick to your mind like a thick glue. I've had fights, though I'm not a very big dude, but with the man in bed, so I can bench Lou Ferrigno. Yellow on the outside.
I heard Lou Ferrigno. Was the sound of the bus in the song, or was that outside your house?
Not outside my house.
Okay, cool. I was kind of hoping.
Can we ask theme songs now? Can we be done theme songs?
No, this show is all theme songs.
Paul, do you have a theme song?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk comics at all. I'm just going to talk theme songs.
Well, really, I mean, we should get not much different from the usual, Scott.
Well, that's true. I ensure that I bring a high standard to you guys every week.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
I'm the Rich Little to this show's Johnny Carson. So,
Paul, I really wish we could see your face because.
No, you don't.
I would love to know what the expression is right now.
I'd kind of hoped when you threw it to Paul, there was just no answer and he left.
I figured there was a good chance.
I can still do that if you want. You know,
we don't want you to, no. But
I don't have introductory music, but I can piggyback on the Three's Company theme with a truly stupid piece of Three's Company trivia, if you like.
Right. Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
All right, well, as we know, the landlord in Three's Company was played by Norman Fell, I believe.
Well, yep. Yeah.
Okay. And my brush with greatness, my bit of stupid trivia, is that I went to high school with Norman Fell's daughter.
Amazing.
There you go. That makes me both topical and famous.
That's really good trivia.
It's really stupid trivia.
How much like Norman was she? And by Norman, I mean the character that he played on Three's Company.
Fortunately, I don't recall her being very much like Norman. She was a very sweet girl, as I recall. But and I scarcely knew her. But there's your stupid trivia for the day.
I think it would have been funny if she wore muumuus like
Mrs. Roper.
That would be very unexpected. Norman Fell's daughter and Mrs. Roper.
Here's the thing you don't know about me, Scott. Most nights I wear muumuus, so that's.
I was gonna ask. I'm hoping.
Yeah. No, that's more.
Okay, when I'm on again in like 3 days on the next podcast, you just wear a muumuu for the.
You're assuming you're gonna be invited back? I don't think. Oh boy. Okay.
I've had a fair number of invites back at this point, and I've.
Much like I say, so Keith and Chris are not with us this week, but hey, who needs them? All right, what beer here? We're here to talk Silver Age and Golden Age, Bronze Age. I've lost it, Brett. You take over.
All right, talk comics. Go. Who starts?
I just told a story about the Conan I got for $5.
That was a good story. Don't tell it again, though. I'm kind of bored by it already.
Paul didn't hear it.
I could just keep telling stories about all my favorite comics.
I got this one. John Tinkus from Another Dimension Comics, so show plug. Hopefully I get some free swag for that. Got me a Steve Ditko.
I want to see one of those. I've only seen John's, but he won't let me touch them because I wreck everything.
Yeah, well, John's kind of that way with you anyway. Like, Riley, don't touch them. Like, what's Riley getting his hands into this time? John's pants. it's one of Ditko's self-published works.
Is he ordering you copies too? Like, are you getting two sets now? Or did he just have doubles for some reason?
No, he just ordered me the one. Because I'm a crazy big Ditko fan. They're good. They're a lot more linear than Ditko used to be. Because, like, he's probably 95 now. And still doing this. Sorry?
This is recent work.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the recent work that you send money to a P.O. box and then that appears in your mailbox.
Wow. That's neat.
2011. He does these pages where he's I'll just show it up to the camera. The audience won't know, but where he incorporates words to, I don't know, just create space or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, the guy still has it. Everybody, you know, shits all over him for the Rand stuff, but who cares? He's a good artist.
Yeah, I mean, as long as if he's making cool stuff, he's making cool stuff, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think everyone gets it.
It's cool that he's really committed to just whatever shit he believes is fine.
Well, and the fact that he still makes it, that's what, like, you know, that's what I'm getting turned on to with Kickstarter more and more, is I just kind of like people who want to do books doing books.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really rad, almost kind of a cooler business model than some publishers, because it's just like, you don't really have to... You don't have to really make a monthly quota to keep the book coming. You just make the book, and those who really like it are the ones who are buying it.
Yeah.
You know, if there's anybody in the business that would have the right to be bitter and break his pencils and stop creating, it would be Steve Ditko, and it's delightful that he's still doing work and he's still doing the kind of work that he's committed to. I mean, whatever your opinions may be of him as an artist, there's no doubt that the guy walks the walk. You know, he does exactly what he's always set out to do, and nothing more and nothing less. I admire that.
Well, and I mean, he walked away from, you know, he walked away from like the premier publisher at the time and just kind of started doing his own thing. Like, he went to DC and did some stuff there, but I don't know, man. I think there's a real sense of empowerment to what he did and what he's still doing. And it's, I don't know. I kind of see, you know, the gears changing a little bit within, you know, comic books and the arts, and the notion of just creating the art for art's sake, I think, is starting to slowly seep its way into comic books, which I actually kind of don't mind.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, any Ditko is good Ditko as far as I'm concerned. I don't have great familiarity with his recent work, but I really do admire the guy for the courage of his convictions. He's an extraordinary figure.
Well, and, you know, like... You know, like I've mentioned before, you know, my series Mysterious Strangers is kind of, you know, quote unquote canceled. And that was, you know, that was a heartbreaking one for me, because it was like, I really just enjoyed drawing that book, but to make the book still exist, I needed the audience to support it. And because within the construct of what, you know, the market dictates, you know, the audience, you know, just wasn't big enough to support the book. But it doesn't mean I don't want to stop making it. It's just within the context of the greater comic book market, I can't really do anything with it. Mm-hmm. So that's why I kind of like this whole notion of, you know, just kind of do it for yourself, and your audience will, you know, that audience will come eventually. Which I think is what Riley does a lot, and just kind of makes his books for him.
Yeah, I just make things that I think are cool. That's it.
Seriously, what's better than that?
Well, it doesn't always mean it makes good, like, economical sense or anything, but...
No, and, you know, that's... who was it that I was reading a book from recently? Jeepers, I can't remember, but I flipped through to the back of the book. I was reading Roald Dahl to my daughter today, and Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, and what's the artist's name who does the? Anyway, I can't remember, but the artist who illustrates the book, you know, on every few pages, his bio was in the back of the book. And what I actually thought was kind of refreshing about it was, you know, it said, you know, he's done work for, you know, these magazines and this magazine or whatever. And he teaches at the Royal Academy of Art in London or whatever. And I thought that was kind of a really neat model of, you know, he had a full-time job, but he was still, that was in the arts, but he was still, you know, doing what he loved on the side, which was drawing illustrations for magazines and the like. And it's an interesting model because sometimes in comic books, like, you know, outside of Marvel and DC and the really high paying, you know, the really high selling image books, it kind of is hard to eke out a living financially.
And the nature of that business at Marvel and DC, maybe not so much lately, but, you know, in the bronze and silver age that I admire, the artists especially had to maintain such a high page rate that they couldn't help but risk of burnout.
Can you start over there?
Sure.
Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just start that point over. We lost. You dropped out for a moment there. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I still had him.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, that's the problem for you guys. Can you still hear me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so
apparently I'm an idiot. Go ahead.
No. We all like you, Keith. You're clever. I mean, Keith. Not Keith, Mo. Mo, I mean, Keith is not at all. Let's face it.
I think by virtue of the fact that you got three new guys here on the show, or three people that are part of your usual crew, I think we deserve some kind of special title. We should be inducted into the Legion of Substitute Heroes or something, because.
Yes, totally.
Wait. I totally have our special title. Just wait for it.
Okay.
Come and knock on our door. Waiting for you. Where the kisses are hers and hers and his.
The unfortunate part.
No, let's just keep it going.
No, the unfortunate part is that you guys can't see Scott dancing to it. That's the part that's really missing here.
Yes. So, Paul, you were making a point about Marvel and DC.
Yeah, God help me if I can remember it. I think the point was we were talking about, you know, guys keeping their hand in comics and loving what they're doing. And I was comparing that to the plight, if you will, of artists at Marvel and DC in the Silver and Bronze Ages, where those guys had to maintain an ungodly high page rate just to get any kind of, to be able to make a living at what they were doing. You know, someone like Jack Kirby doing 3-4 pages a day, you know, working 7 days a week. And then you still see that these guys, you know, wanted to continue to work instead of the love for the form. So that also always amazes me about artists is they're, you know, it's one thing to do the work. It's another thing not to end up resenting and hating the work just because you're chained to your desk so often.
Mm-hmm. So Riley and Scott, what are your page rates? Is it three a day?
Oh, that page rate. I
yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I'm like,
sorry, right. Yes, I'm not asking how much you charge.
I don't know. Well, if I'm not going crazy, like if I'm not having a nervous breakdown, like page and a half a day or so is good for me. I'm happy.
Seems to me, Riley, you've had somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 books over the last couple of years come out. I mean,
that's true.
You've been quite prolific. One of the things I know you've mentioned to me before is your speed, and you're working on that, right?
No, I do an issue every 5 weeks. Unless, again, I'm like Riley, I'm having a nervous breakdown. So I've been having a nervous breakdown for a while, so I'm a little behind. But yeah, every 5 weeks.
Right. I think Paul, go ahead, Riley, go ahead.
A lot of it, though, I think for me, came from, and I think it's been that way with comic artists historically, is just producing a volume of work when you're not like super high profile creator, creating enough work to get by, right? And I just got into the habit of like, I'd work in the day at a job, and then I'd do editorial and advertising stuff, and, you know, then draw some more comics. So I'd draw like a monthly book and do stuff for magazines and work a job. And it's just hard to stop doing that, even when you can stop doing that.
Yeah, I'm at sort of a turning point right now with my, you know, with my comics career, where I'm seeing not enough income coming in for the amount of work that I'm putting into it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out how to still do it, but also, you know, how to find something that is a little bit more stable.
Yeah.
So it's a strange dichotomy, the world of comics. Like, if you're not producing a high volume, or, you know, working for the big two, or having a book that does, you know, huge image like numbers of the books that do really well at Image, it is kind of challenging to stay afloat sometimes.
And, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, because in the 1940s, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby were paid $5 a page to do Captain America. Yeah, that's not $5 each. They had to split that $5. And in order to keep their rate of production up, in order to do enough pages to do a living wage, they started developing storytelling techniques that we now take for granted in superhero comics. But this idea of having, you know, big panels that are horizontal, that fill the whole width of the page, the idea of having that action beat in the center of the page, that was something that Simon and Kirby originally developed so they could draw their pages faster and get that $5 quicker.
But I've actually been talking to Mike Allred a lot about that lately, because that's the only way that I can kind of foresee continuing to do this, is increasing my, you know, my speed per page, my pace, I guess, but still kind of turning out a nice enough quality.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way I can kind of think to do that is try to work smaller, because I work generally pretty small anyway, but my finished pages are all, you know, full 11 by 17 scale. But if I can pull that down, theoretically, I should be able to work faster.
Well, and different people have tried that, right? Like, didn't Gil Kane start doing that?
Yeah. Yeah, Dave Michael still does it. He still works pretty small.
Yeah.
And Toth was doing print size for, like, I think the majority of, like, the 70s and 80s when he was producing.
See, I think with him, he's the exception to me as opposed to the rule. Because his stuff looks, when it's smaller... he just has to simplify his information, and the more he simplifies the information that he puts on a page, the cooler it is.
Yeah. Well, it's all economics at that point, right? Like, you know, he's economical per page, per panel.
I have these Johnny Thunder comics.
Oh, where did you find those? I haven't been able to find them anywhere.
I found them on a show that he drew, and it's weird because somebody inked it. Maybe nobody inked it in the first issue. So yeah, I don't know how big they are. Like, I don't know how big he drew it, right?
That guy's arm looks pretty detailed. My guess is that's closer to print size. Like, if you compare it with his Zorro work.
Yeah, but look at this dude's face. It's too big.
This is how Riley and I talk over Skype, as we just hold stuff up to the camera.
Look at this guy. Well, look how nice that is. That looks like he had time to do that Zorro stuff. This looks like he was just getting paid.
Yeah.
And then in issue two, they have somebody ink it.
Mm-hmm.
And super it's like a whole different person drew it. Like, yeah. It doesn't, the structure kind of goes out the window. And
yeah.
I don't know.
How much time do you guys spend just studying these older artists? These artists from, let's say, I don't know, the 70s.
Oh, yeah, right. We have a topic. I don't spend a lot of like physical time sitting and studying them. I did a lot of that in college, but I always keep the ones open around me that I like. I always keep Bruno Premiani really close. The artist on Doom Patrol.
Weird.
Because his actual panel, like, layouts in the panel are always very simple,
and very economical, but he gets really detailed with his inking. So I'm looking through Doom Patrol number 89 right now. The Animal Vegetable Mineral Menace, which is the greatest cover to a comic book ever.
Wow. I don't know how to read that stuff. That stuff is, I don't know.
Yeah, find that as the show picture.
Good. It's a beautiful cover. It's a beautiful character that makes literally no sense.
You like Carmen Infantino and stuff too, right? Like you like that DC sort of superhero stuff. I don't know what to call it. I guess it's just DC superhero stuff.
See, I've never understood Silver and Bronze Age. Is Doom Patrol Silver Age?
What year are we talking about?
Isn't the cutoff
64?
Yeah, that's Silver. Yeah.
Conan number one, as I understand it, Conan number one is the first Bronze Age comic, right?
I think there's, you know, you can put a flag a lot of different places. I've read, the transition to Bronze Age was the death of Gwen Stacy in Spider-Man, for instance.
That's right.
Because Bronze Age generally, Bronze Age is very similar to Silver, but I think the difference, at least as I perceive it, is that the stories have just a little bit more of an edge, just a little grittier. It also sort of coincides with the relaxation of the comics code in the early 70s. It still existed, but they allowed them to start bringing in some horror elements, some monsters, some crime. The comics started to talk about social ills. You look at Steve Gerber's early books, they're kind of, to me, the classic Bronze Age pattern, where it's still superhero stuff, but they're talking about slumlords and drug dealers and political corruption, and those just aren't stories that you commonly saw tackled in the Silver Age.
Yeah. I like all the rise of like the horror stuff. All that horror stuff makes me so happy.
Completely off topic. Look at this panel of Elastigirl with holding a switchblade.
Yes, listening audience. Look at this panel.
That's awesome. Well, everybody should just pull out their Doom Patrol 89.
Huh, who doesn't have one?
I bought this at a show a little while ago. It's called Baron Werewolf's Haunted Library. I think it's got Alfredo Alcala art or something in it. And it's a story about a cat lady.
Awesome.
I like that. I wish more stuff that got made like that. I wish there was more of a venue for just sort of weirdo horror stuff. It just doesn't seem to fly.
So speaking of cat ladies, this is not even on topic at like remotely.
No, not really new.
I kind of wish Chris was here. I watched the Halle Berry Catwoman.
Ouch.
And it was great. I don't understand. Like, I do understand why everybody hated it, but it's like, it's such an, like, there's no validity to the reason for not liking that movie. If it had been called Cat Lady and not Catwoman, we would have gone, that's fucking awesome. It's a fucking awesome movie. But because it was called Catwoman, everybody's, oh, how dare they? Her name's not Salida Kyle. Like, fuck off. Like, how? There were three Catwomans on the old Batman TV show. One of them was black.
And I'm quite fond of Eartha Kitt as Catwoman, but I take up the voice of the audience here, I think it is reasonable that if you're going to leverage that brand identity of Catwoman to get the punters into the theater to lay down their $8, they have a reasonable expectation of seeing Catwoman on the screen, and I'm not sure that film satisfied that expectation. I think it was, you know, I can see where it can't be fun, but as a comics fan, I think you can reasonably object to Catwoman, the film.
Yes,
but we lost Scott. I don't know if anybody's complaining about that.
I thought that the part of Catwoman that most alarmed me was that the villain, I think it was Faye Dunaway, played the bad person, right? Wasn't her sinister plot in Catwoman shipping a bad batch of facial cream or something like that? I think that's what she was up to.
Of course it was.
Which would affect all five of us on this show, I'm sure.
All right. Well, we might as well carry on as if Scott's here.
Yeah, no, he's going to come back. The thing is, you keep that in mind. Unfortunately,
and you know when he does, you know exactly what's going to happen.
We're going to get that music.
Uh-huh. Yes, the music will come in. Probably his music, not the Three's Company music. All right, let's move on. All right, 70s. And thanks for trying to keep us on track here, Paul. So let's go back. When I say to you, let's just do some word association. Let's keep this simple. Yeah, I'm going to say it to both of you. Riley, you're there as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I just lost you on camera for a second there. But all right, word association. So I'm going to say, Riley, it's 1970s. I say artist, first one that pops in your mind.
Corbin.
Really? And why is that?
Because I love Creepy and Eerie. Or Wrightson. That's like the when I really sort of found out that there was 70s comics that I cared about, it's when I found out about Creepy and Eerie. I mean, before there was some, I don't know, there's some Avengers and stuff that I don't mind. But 70s horror comics, I found out about them when I started working at the comic store, and they just... I didn't know I liked so many old comics.
Now, Paul, in the 70s, Marvel seemed to me like they really tried to mainstream and monetize the 70s horror comics. They had a lot of the Dracula and the Blade and these, you know, these different series that Frankenstein showing up and that type of thing.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you.
No, please go ahead.
Like you have your two sort of avenues though, right? Because DC had more of like the horror like anthology titles, like Weird War and House of Mystery, House of Secrets, Mysterious Horror, House of Our Love. I think it's an Alex Toth comic. That's the only reason I know. Sinister Secret House of Our Love.
Wow.
I don't know. Whereas Marvel did more of like the ongoing like Giant Size Man things, Tomb of Dracula. Whatever, right? Anyways, sorry, that's my two cents.
No, exactly. Yeah. Paul, what do you think of that?
About Marvel's horror books, specifically?
Yeah, specifically well, Marvel's.
I have a soft spot for him. I think Tomb of Dracula is maybe the best continuing Marvel comic of the 70s all by itself. I'm just a terrific run from Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan and Tom Palmer on that book for, you know, 70 odd issues or whatever they did. But you know, the other Marvel horror books of the age, Werewolf by Night, Frankenstein, Living Mummy, you know, maybe not as good, but they represented, or even their secondary characters, and like, or it ended up being primary characters like Morbius and Man-Thing's been around forever, and then the peculiar fringe characters like Son of Satan and Brother Voodoo. I mean, they were really ready to try anything, and I think part of it was there was a pent up demand for horror features in these mainstream books that, you know, was uncorked by a couple things, by Marvel securing additional distribution, by the relaxation of the comics code. Also, I mean, I was a kid in that era, and horror was a big thing. Specifically, you know, The Exorcist came out in 1972, had a huge impact on popular culture, and that was reflected in Marvel's comics of the era. So I actually have a real affection for Marvel's horror books, and I wish they're notably absent from Marvel's digital services. I'd love to see them be more widely available today because they really were a hoot.
And there's really like weird stuff too. Like when Marvel was doing the black and white horror magazines, there's some really cool stuff, and they're really cool artists, and like just different Dracula takes and. Trying to think what else. Monsters Unleashed in one of those Marvel premiere magazines?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there's
the magazines.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say the magazines came out from Curtis, which was an allied company of Marvel. They were dollar or more. They were black and white. They were entirely not covered by the code. They were pitched at an adult audience, and the content could be pretty, you know, pretty extreme for its age.
Yeah. I buy those whenever I can find them. I just buy them just because there's cool stuff in them usually. Like there's at least an artist I like or something. Just something neat in them.
Yeah, I was reading Vampire Tales, I think. The Vampire Tales number one, the other day, which was one of their black and white books, and it had a Mobius, the living vampire story in it. And the level of violence in that was shocking. You know, Morbius, you know, it really was a predator. He pounces on some woman that he finds in a nightclub, brings her home, drains her of blood. It was really hardcore, savage horror that I'd have a hard time seeing maybe even in some contemporary books.
And it was in that sort of Conan format, so it was kind of titillating too. right?
Yeah, well, I loved Savage Sword as a kid for that same reason. And Savage Sword, you know, you might get, it wasn't heavy metal, but you might get a glimpse of a breast every two or three issues in Savage Sword.
Stuff like this, right? This bizarre, can you see this?
We got a little bit of a glare there, but it looks like
Marvel preview. It's got like Gene Colan and Steve Bissett in it. I don't know. I love that stuff.
All right, Scott, you got something to say there? I'll give you a shot there.
Am I coming back through?
Yep.
Yeah, you bet.
Awesome.
I thought he had forgotten.
You totally nailed it, though.
Also, Howard the Duck magazine, which I think is an important comic.
Wow.
Riley's purposely not acknowledging All for Love by Sting, Rod Stewart, and Bryan Adams.
Well, I'm really excited now. I got my box of magazines. Oh, also, here's another super important comic that there's only four issues of it ever, Blazing Combat.
Okay, so what do you consider those two books important? What do you mean by that?
Blazing Combat was a big deal because they told war stories that were negative, right? And I think they ended up pulping the third and fourth. No. Yeah, the third and fourth issues got pulped because there was stories in there that were talking negatively, had a negative sort of spin on the Korean War. And so the third and fourth issues they're hard to find. So it's a really cool comic. And then Howard the Duck, like, because it was so weird for Marvel to be making a book like that.
Response, Paul?
Well, I think speaking specifically to Howard the Duck, that also indicates what kind of an era it was at Marvel. I mean, they would try anything. Howard the Duck was a throwaway character that Gerber created in an issue of early Man-Thing story. Killed the character, I think, in the first issue. There was a letter-writing campaign to bring him back, so he did. And then it became this really unexpected success. But that's the era of comics that I most bonded with, not just because I was 12 years old when they came out, but also because during that, like the Roy Thomas editor-in-chief era at Marvel, like 72 to 74, 75, something like that, that era really was practically, I mean, just look at the crazy books you had. You had Howard the Duck. You had Don McGregor doing Killraven and his very idiosyncratic Black Panther. You had Steve Gerber doing Defenders. You had, and even the mainstream books, like the Steve Englehart, Captain America and Avengers books, were very strange and very creative and took crazy risks. And that's something that I think was lost, certainly when you get into the 80s, the Jim Shooter era, where things are very tightened down. And suddenly, you know, the books started coming out on time and the company started making money. So, you know, you have to take your hat off for that. But there was this just crazy anything goes sense to those early 70s books that I still really value.
I think some of those books like Howard the Duck were so cool because they were not superhero comics. They're like the closest thing. There's no Fantagraphics, I don't think, right? That's like there's some like weird little companies, but I don't know. I don't know why I like Howard the Duck so much. I guess it's a story about a guy whose girlfriend is a human and he's a duck. And they fight Dr. Long, but it's not really fighting. Like, I don't know. It's just really cool. I haven't examined some of this stuff on an academic level. I like hearing you talk about it, Paul. It's kind of, I didn't know that Howard the Duck was a throwaway character either.
Well, how cool would it be to have a PhD on Howard the Duck?
Awesome. I mean,
that would be a diploma worth showing off.
You know, Paul, you and Steve Gerber, obviously, you know him quite well, right?
I didn't know him very well. I knew him a little bit. I got a chance to work with him very briefly when he was part of the Ultraverse crew. And he consented to let me write an inventory script for Sludge, which was a swamp monster book he was doing for Ultraverse at that time. So I got to correspond with him a little bit. And I was at a couple dinners with him. And he was a really cool guy.
This is not a 70s comic, but did you ever read his Hard Time? Hard Time?
You know, I never did. No, I never did.
Get it. I think it's my favorite thing that he ever wrote for me anyways. I really loved Howard the Duck, but I've read that series probably like, I don't know, 15 times the whole way through.
Wow.
And it was, you know, one of his sort of later works. It's pretty special.
It was a Vertigo series, wasn't it? It came out quite late in early 2000s. And
yeah, it was there was a different imprint. It was like they were trying to do like another Vertigo. I think it was called Focus or Helix. It was one of those ones.
Helix. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Focus rings a bell.
Yeah.
Something. I know it's one of our usual co-hosts, Chris's all-time favorite books. He talked about it before being great. So, Steve Gerber. All right. So, see what we did there? We talked a little 70s comics. How about that, Kowal Chuck? Or as we like to call you, Kowal Suck.
Yeah, I'm loving that. That's...
What do you guys think about Alfredo Alcala and Nestor Redondo and all the guys that came over from the Philippines? Because I'm a huge fan. Like Tony Dezaniga is one of my favorite artists, and I think he started working in the 70s, right?
I'm not familiar with their work. What were they on?
Conan, mostly the Conan books, right? As anchors.
Yeah, and Jonah Hex, and then they just kind of took out, like, but they're like Tony Dezaniga is such a good artist that he just take over stuff, right? Like if John Buscema kind of got bored or sort of lazy or whatever, he'd just send him sort of rough layouts, and Tony Dezaniga would just draw the rest of Conan, and you'd still get your John Buscema Conan, but it'd be through a filter of him, or if like Alfredo Alcala was around. I just started thinking about them because they just produce, like, I think there's specifically a Tony Dezaniga and Ernie Chan, or is that Ernie Chan's real name? Because he had two names.
I think it was Chua, but he published under Chan at first.
Yeah. I think both of those guys, to me, and Alfredo Alcala, I think should get more love.
Well, isn't there a story about them coming into the industry, like that whole group of non-American artists and the reason that they came into the industry?
Was because it was cheaper, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I think.
I heard the story, and I can't remember where I read it, but that I think it was Marvel went on a trip to the Philippines and just said, you know, who can draw, and they had tryouts or whatever. And then there's some guys that were just coming in and be like, I'll do 20 pages a day. Or I'll do 15 pages a day. And
wow.
People were getting hired based on just these crazy, like, workloads. I could just be made up, though. You know what I mean? That could just
yeah, be. Well, but that's what I say, because it's like, I know I've heard something to that account, you know, and so it's interesting that we've all, or some of us have heard it.
A lot of comic book urban legends out there. Is a thing.
That's right.
So. Well, it's an early example of outsourcing. And in a digital world now, we don't think a lot about, you know, there are artists in South America and you use them and that's great, but you can get to them so fast. It actually kind of, it curls my toes a little bit to think of all these pages of original art going in the mail overseas to the Philippines to be inked and then sent back to Marvel. Okay. You know, but it worked out. And I think your observation of those guys deserve more credit is spot on, specifically because of the books they are on and the artists they worked with on, you know, Gil Kane, John Buscema were both guys that were action artists. And we were talking earlier about how you got to work fast to, you know, keep your page rate up. And they often weren't that interested in doing backgrounds. You know, and sometimes they were almost like doing keyframes for animation. So, but backgrounds are so critical to a book like Conan because, you know, an artist on a fantasy book can't just be a great action artist. They also have to be a production designer. They have to convince me that I'm in the Hyborian Age. And when you look at some of those, especially Savage Sword, where those guys did a lot of the work, the backgrounds are just beautiful. I'm convinced that I'm in that world. And a lot of that, I think, is a credit to the anchors as opposed to the artist.
Have you read that art book that Big John, I think it's called the Big John Buscema, or IDW put it out, and it was a catalog or something. It's pretty recent. It came out like a year or two ago. There's a part in there that he's talking about working on Conan. And I don't know when the interview is from. I mean, obviously before he passed away, but he's saying that Alfredo Alcala got everything all wrong. He added all kinds of details to it. And you see his pencils. You see Buscema's pencils. And I love him. He's one of my, like, I love him, right?
But then yeah, I love him too.
That finished Savage Sword, the first Savage Sword that Alfredo Alcala inked, and you're like, it looks like etching. Like, it looks like it's amazing. And then in the John Buscema book, he's like, yeah, he added all this stuff, and wrecked all the faces.
Yeah, those guys, you know, those Philip, like, those guys had a pretty heavy brush. But, you know, I also think if you read, that was a drum beat from John Buscema. And I love his work, and I love his Conan especially. But he was never satisfied with his inkers. He always wanted to do his own inks. And when you see his own inks in select issues of Conan or the first issue of Tarzan he did with Roy Thomas, it's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, his work is really good, but he was just so slow when he was inking his own work that it was no way that Marvel could let him do that. So the only inker that he personally endorsed was his brother, Sal, right? Who also was a guy that could go so fast that he was immediately dragooned and turned into a penciler, although he originally joined Marvel specifically to be an inker.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. I like Sal Buscema a lot too. Especially when he's inking John Buscema. Tom Palm, that's okay, so the Filipino guys I really like. Like I have a I keep a Tony Dezuniga plate by my computer.
Is it
a frontispiece?
Is it there for a reference material, or is it there because you just love it, or
no? Because it makes me happy. And then this, because it's interesting speaking about those guys and how they're heavy-handed inks, right?
Yeah.
So when he was at the con here before he passed away, I was talking to him and I was like, "Well, this is kind of weird, but." Like, if I pencil something, instead of, like, just a straight commission, would you ink it? And he's like, yeah, sure. Cool, right? I was super excited. He just redrew the whole thing. Same hand position. And he's like, you have no idea what Jonah Hex looks like. What are you doing? And he's like, Jonah
Hex. That's an awesome Jonah Hex. And Jonah Hex is definitely one of my favorite characters from the 70s.
You know, Tony had a heavy brush, too. And sometimes a little heavier than I liked on characters like Conan, but boy, that guy could really ink women. When you're looking through an issue of Savage Sword and you flip to a page and one of those dancing girls is there, wow, you know, because he had a tendency to ink everybody with very heavy facial features, almost looked like they were wearing mascara or something. Yeah, Conan might occasionally look a little too dark in that regard, but wow, the women that he inked were just stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Same
Scott,
with
Nestor.
You okay, Scott?
Yeah, I'm still here.
I don't enjoy yourself.
I don't know what anybody's talking about, so I'm being respectful.
We're talking about Catwoman.
Okay, yeah. Here's the thing with Catwoman.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for ruining our flow.
Hey, you know, the dude was in the penalty box for 2 minutes. He's back on the ice. He can talk about Catwoman. He paid the price. It's okay.
Nice job for the Californian there talking some Canadian hockey to us. There we go. That's
hey,
way to fit it.
I love hockey. I used to play hockey. We can talk hockey all night if you want.
All right, Scott, you were going to say Catwoman.
So we didn't like it because it wasn't Selina Kyle. We didn't like it because... She's. I'm guessing to an extent some of the problem people had with it was she was black, and that there was no like Batman supervillain in it. Even though the supervillain was awesome, it was Sharon Stone, and she had unbreakable skin. Come on, that movie was the tits.
Literally, what she was wearing.
It was literally Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man, but with a black female lead. It was wonderful. Bring on the hate mail, baby.
All right. Speaking of which, we're going to go back to the 70s here. Because you talk about how some people may have disliked it because the character or the actress was black. One of the things about the 70s was really there was a rise of minorities in the books. I mean, there's, you know, Black Panther and Luke Cage and these different, you know, Shang-Chi. That's one of the positives about the 70s is they were now given the opportunity to be the lead characters in books.
Mm-hmm.
Power Man and Iron Fist promo of Iron Fist with the hand over his mouth and pointing.
Yeah, when he's like, you're not buying the book, and Luke's getting mad.
Fuck,
that was in the 80s, right before it got canceled. But
oh, that's still today my favorite comic book.
Well, episode. that was the MD Bright, Doc Bright, who's I love. So
that issue, there's an issue when Iron Fist, I think he gets killed. He dies, right? Then he gets punched through a wall.
Yeah, that's the final issue of Power Man Iron Fist
1. Yeah, that really wrecked me up. Like that messed me up when I was a kid. I was like, he just keeps punching him. Yeah. It was disturbing.
Yeah. Anyways, the rise of minority characters. Paul, historical perspective, because that's what you're here for.
Because I'm the old guy, right?
Go no,
you're the smart one.
No, I'm definitely not the smart one. Well, I'm going to plug myself here because I just wrote 3,000 words about Iron Fist at my blog. Which
I'm glad you don't have any video of Paul because I do not want to see you plug yourself on air.
I'm plugging and unplugging myself as we speak.
Okay, this gets an explicit rating. Well,
so
I was actually going to make that joke, then I thought I'm too classy to do that to Paul. If he wasn't on this episode, or if it was you saying that, I would have.
No, let it rip. Let it rip. But at my blog, which is longboxgraveyard.com, I just wrote 3,000 words about Iron Fist. But it was the first, 15 issues or so of this book. And also, Claremont and Byrne stuff, which was, really cool. But it's probably not what I should be talking about in response to your question, which was about minority characters at Marvel. I mean, Iron Fist, I love Iron Fist, but it's a white guy. Right, he's a white guy that winds up at a mystical city and in the course of a montage acquires a lifetime of combat training. The other characters you mentioned, I think Luke Cage is notable for a couple reasons. First, he might be the only character from the only black superhero from that character that doesn't have black in his name. He's not Black Dragon, Black Lightning, Black Goliath, Black Panther. He's just Luke Cage.
Misty Knight showed up in Iron Fist, so
that's
first,
true.
Right?
That's true. Yeah. But Luke Cage is just such a cool character, and he's another character I think that broke into comics not because of civil rights or anything, but because Marvel was looking to make a dollar and blaxploitation pictures were making money. And let's see if we can get some of that audience. Let's see if we can catch that vibe. So they turned to, a real urban guy like who? George Tuska? not exactly a gritty urban artist. And produced this character that, the books weren't great, but the character was great. And, he's still with us, and now he's going to be a TV star in the next couple of years. That's pretty cool.
One of the things actually that does get me, I go back to the 70s, and you read these books, and like I say, the rise of some of these minority characters. And you could tell it's a white guy who has never been, on the streets or writing it. Like, the dialogue is just so what they think that dialogue is supposed to sound like.
Absolutely.
It's really terrible. But I love it anyways. I love that he says Christmas.
Oh, Christmas is awesome. I mean, and if he doesn't say Christmas in the Netflix show, I'm going to throw my remote at the screen. I mean, they have to pay it off somehow. That's Luke Cage.
Yeah, exactly. All right, 70s. I did this earlier. I did it with Riley. I'm going to do it with you, Scott. You weren't here. I say 70s. I say artist. Word association. First one when I say 70s artist. Who's the first guy that pops in your mind?
Oh, man. I didn't read a lot of books from the 70s, to be honest. I kind of bypassed it 60s to the 80s.
All right. First artist when I say 60s.
Premiani. It's always Premiani.
Hmm. And why is that?
I love Doom Patrol so much.
Yeah.
Doom Patrol was just that one, like, Robot Man as a character probably was a black guy. Like, if if you look at the way that he was written and the way that he would, he acted within the book, like, he was, he probably was a black character, even though Cliff Steele was white, but... And I kind of dug that about him.
Who else from the 60s, Scott?
Well, the 60s was kind of like the pinnacle of great artists, right? Because there was that sort of that really stylized version of, how to make panels look. It wasn't just fill panels full of detail. It was, stick to that format of extreme close-up, medium shot, far shot. Like, it was all very structured.
Have you seen the How to Draw the Marvel Way?
Oh, sure.
Essentially?
Yeah, it's basically that. And I kind of miss that. You see that in a few guys. Like, who was it on Superman that I really liked in the 60s? Wayne Boring?
Yeah.
He's like, that dude is like still the epitome of like Superman artwork for me.
It's so bad.
It's so awesome. It's so awesome.
His chest is just like he's massive and he's so like
was the best part. Superman should be massive. Superman shouldn't be like a cut. Like Superman's.
I agree, but he's like barrel chested. He's like
Rob Liefeld-esque.
He has a rib cage that goes from like his armpits to like his hips.
That's what I'm saying. It's like a barrel. Like he's just got a barrel sideways on top of his.
My favorite Superman memory was a Wayne Boring comic in which Superman had been turned into a lion by an alien version of Cersei, the witch. I still don't quite understand it. And he comes to the Daily Planet to talk to Jimmy because he needs Jimmy's help because he's a lion. And I assume Jimmy is on like if the Daily Planet were a building, I'd say it's what, like 40 floors tall or whatever. Superman crashes up through the floor to talk to Jimmy. And I'm assuming Jimmy's on like the 30th floor or something. So like how many floors did Superman break through to get to his pal Jimmy? I miss 60s Superman because it makes no sense.
I'll take Kurt Swan, thanks. Let's
I don't mind that like done in one like stories. But that I have such a hard time with the DC comics, like superhero comics of that era, because they're just so crazy. Because like you said, Superman's a lion and he's flying through a building and like...
They're almost impossible to read, but that's what makes them so charming for me. It's like, how do I get through this story of Superman as a lion? Well, he's a lion. I kind of want to see it through to the end.
I have a trick. I have a trick I use to be able to read Silver Age stories like that, because your brain can melt if you try to read two or three of them. Like we're talking about the Legion of Substitute Heroes earlier from Superboy or from early Adventure Comics, and those will just drive you nuts. They make no sense. But what I started to do and this is really stupid, but when I read those old Silver Age stories, I pretend they're Broadway musicals, and then they work. Because in a Broadway musical, you don't think anything about characters telling you what they're feeling and what they're thinking and standing in the center of the stage and belting out this ballad about their heart and their soul and their desires. And that's what the Silver Age is. All the characters are just emoting out loud all the time. And
there's so going to be a future We Talk Comics where it's just all of us singing the dialogue from a book that we agree on.
I tell you, it works. It really works.
Well, I have another technique for Marvel comics from the 60s and 70s where you have like a really cool illustration and then they describe what's happening in the illustration in the narration box. Like yes. in Tomb of Dracula, it happens a lot. Like they show what Dracula's doing, then Dracula's saying, or he's thinking like, oh, I'm going to go into that cave over there that's lit. Even though you can see him moving towards the cave where the light's coming from.
And then there's a caption that says, Dracula creeps towards the cave. Yeah.
I stopped reading the narration boxes and the any like thought balloons. And if you just read the dialogue, it's awesome.
I miss that narration, though, because like when I buy a new comic now, like I'll read a comic in like 4 or 5 minutes. Like it takes no time at all. Whereas like a Silver Age comic, like to this day, still takes me like 15 minutes to get through.
True.
And I really like Paul's notion of the Broadway musical, because everything is like, it's kind of Shakespeare at Shakespeare's worst.
Mm-hmm.
So many soliloquies, like these guys' internal monologues are so much more complicated than mine. Mine's basically, oh, cleavage, and just kind of move on through my day.
Well, you see, now when you see a Silver Age soliloquy, just think of it as, you know, it's Les Miserables and Inspector Javert is singing about the stars, right? He's making an ethos statement that tells you what that character's all about. That's the only way I can read Silver Surfer, let me tell you, because it's nonstop soliloquies. Thinking of it as a musical opens up a whole new world of comics for you.
That's true, yeah.
Maybe it should just be a musical. Maybe we should just stop these superhero movies and just make them all musicals.
I would.
Well, they totally tried with that. They tried with that Spider-Man stage production, and it was a.
Oh, didn't
it
they
was
have
a
in
disaster.
The 80s? Didn't they have a Captain America one as well?
Oh God, help us! Probably. Yeah.
Have you guys ever seen the Macy's Day Parade? This like the Marvel Macy's Day Parade.
Oh yeah.
Footage.
First off, before you go on, Scott, I just want to mention My eyes are up here. Now go ahead.
You have like you have nothing but wall. Like my picture of you is Mo taking up like the bottom tenth of the screen. So I'm looking at
no, it's way worse. You don't actually want him to take up that much more.
Keith is already for us. He's suggested we call this. He sent me this yesterday. Suggested we call this the Superior We Talk Comics podcast, and he's photoshopped a picture that's going to be the picture actually for the show. You guys are going to be pretty amazed. That's all I'll say.
I can't wait. And we should let Keith's employer know that's why he took the day off of work.
Well, he did send it to me about two when he's anyways. all right. I just want to say, let's throw out – here's a name. Nobody's mentioned this name, and I've heard – I mean people rave about him, and I don't know that to the common fan that he's talked about that much, but to people who are in the industry or follow the industry for a long time, they is talk it, about – he was
– Is it Dr. Druid?
No. He was talked Dr. about
– right here.
I love Dr. Druid.
Nick Fury, Steranko.
Yeah, I have all those issues.
Any thoughts on? I mean, a lot of people talk about how influential he was. So, Riley, you have all those issues. What do you see in Steranko's art that influences people to this day?
I love those montage covers. Those photo montage covers are so cool. There's the design. You know, when you read the new Fraction Iron Fist that David wrote or drew,
uh-huh. It's
totally Steranko. Totally Steranko to me. There's all those like little inset panels, and when you go from Steranko, Captain America, to Steranko, Nick Fury, it's like a whole new thing. He's not doing a sort of Kirby thing; he's doing his thing, and it's pretty cool. The Hounds of the Baskerville story is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I just read the first three of those because I couldn't. Because Marvel Unlimited doesn't have issue 5, unfortunately. But I like there's that one page with him and the Baroness where they're just about to, you know, get together on the couch, and it's just the way the panels are, and like, you know, the gun is hanging off the chair, you know, and then they're a little closer, and then there's the gun again and stuff like that. You know, it's brilliant montage work. I mean, like, and Steranko's nuts. So, I mean, I love that even more.
Yeah, Steranko's Strange Tales was like, and still is kind of my book because it's always him and Ditko, like Ditko's Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
So those are always just a blast to read because you get this, like, when you look at Steranko's work, which what I don't understand is, like the actual amount of time a single panel takes him,
mm-hmm.
the detail that he includes. I'm looking at Strange Tales number 157 right now. It's utterly insane, and he inks it all.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how he was sticking to a monthly schedule, adding in everything that he did.
I don't think he was.
Well, I mean, Strange Tales was coming out monthly, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was like a 12 or an 18-page feature, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's true. No, well, yeah, it looks like it.
I mean, 18 pages is still a lot, but
18 pages is still a lot.
It's almost
yeah, no question.
Full modern issue, but
12 pages. That's how long this story is.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, Steranko was awesome, and you know, as a guy, obviously, he never lacked for confidence. I think Orson Welles said, if you're going to make a movie, you should either know everything there is to know about making movies or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Steranko's a guy that came to comics with his own ideas about the way he was going to do things. And it's really difficult to understand the impact he had unless you look at – the best way to understand the impact he had is to look at all the other books that Marvel shipped in the same month that his book came out. And it looks like it came from the future. Or from Mars or some other crazy place, because and it wasn't just his drawing skill. It was that it's like he took all this crazy, unfettered Jack Kirby imagination and then fused it with an understanding of cinema and cinematic storytelling, which nobody was doing in comics at the time. And it really is just brilliant work. And the thing about him is that he didn't do a lot of comics. I think at Marvel, he did maybe 36 books, maybe, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood. But it had such an outsized impact on the field that we you know, we still feel it today, which is remarkable. He's one of the real greats in the business.
He's really nice. When I met him, he was really nice anyways.
Yeah, when I met him, it was a little different. I'll quickly tell the story because it was at San Diego Comic Con. I had my son with me, and he was young and in a stroller. And then one of my friends was there as well, and we were chatting with Steranko for a bit. And after a while, I came to the realization that he thought that we were gay. A gay couple with my son. And so it was just this kind of odd moment as the conversation just kind of morphed, and you're like, no, oh, this isn't even worth it. You're never going to believe this, you know. So.
Strange tales.
Yeah.
First off, I'm upset though, Brett, to hear you have another friend. What the hell? What do you do? Anyways, here's a name. I'm going to throw out a name of somebody who I'm a huge fan of. And that's right, Paul. I'm going to get into it with you here because I know you're not. Ross Andrew.
I like Ross Andrew.
All right. Paul, you don't like Ross Andrew. What's your issue with his art?
I don't, especially. Now, I'm familiar with him mostly from Spider-Man in the 70s, like 1974 to 75, like the tail end of Jerry Conway's run on that book. And to be fair, those weren't great issues of Spider-Man. So I may be holding Mr. Andrew to to account for stories that weren't his fault. But looking back on his work on Spidey, I found his anatomy a little tortured. I found the expressions of his characters a little reedy and a little ugly, frankly. In a book that thrived, you know, maybe still, I love Ditko, but probably the classic look for Spider-Man is John Romita Sr. And he drew all those characters very handsome, very pretty, very kind of romance comic style. I think that's just where I imprinted, like, you know, like a reptile that's born and the first thing it sees is what it imprints on. And Mr. Andrews' work on Spider-Man especially just didn't correspond with that expectation. So maybe I've slighted him, but he's not my favorite, I will admit.
Hey, and Scott, we're going to get you to do the rebuttal because you said you like them and you're an artist who can explain it much better than me. God.
Ross Andrew. I have a lot of affection for Ross Andrew because he came in on The Flash on issue, I think it was 174, and number 175 was when, why am I blanking on her name? Barry Allen's wife.
Iris.
Thank you, Iris Allen. Was when the Reverse Flash murdered her. And he drew, I think, up until issue like 195 or something, before, you know, the Flash's, before Barry Allen's life, you know, completely fell apart. So I have a lot of affection for him because of his run on the Flash, which I thought was really, really solid.
What was that, Andrew? I thought that was Carmine Infantino drawing it at that point.
No, Carmine came back on around, I think it was issue 195, because he was the guy from that point on until the end of the series. But Ross had a good 15-20 issue run, which I thought was fabulous.
Okay, so Infantino did all the issues that were the trial of the Flash were just before Crisis. Okay, I remember that now.
Yeah, but everything that kicked all that off happened in those sort of 175 to sort of 185. Like that sowed the seeds. So Ross has always been, I've always had a lot of affection for him for being part of that wonderful, wonderful run.
And of course, as the swing roll vote, Ross Andrew's awesome. One other guy, we're getting kind of near the end here, I think probably, but one other name I'm just going to throw out there because he's my favorite, pretty much arguably my favorite creator of all time. And he first started doing work in the 70s. I want to know what everybody thinks of Jim Starlin.
I like Starlin. But do you like his writing or do you like his art? Or do you like both?
I like both. I mean, I think both are. His writing, you could see the talent, but you could see early on, if you read his books in the 70s, you know, when he's first introducing Thanos and these different type of things, you could see he's growing as a writer. You could see that he has concepts, but he doesn't know yet how to tell the story. You know, his dialogue and his pacing and everything like that is a little off. He doesn't really click for him yet. I don't think, until you know, somewhere in the 80s. But his art was always, to me, just dynamic and fantastic and powerful. So
I've always loved Death in the Family. And I'm not actually familiar terribly well with Jim Starlin's work aside from that. I wasn't big on the Galactic characters in the 70s and 80s from Marvel. But Death in the Family, I think, still reads extremely, extremely well. So thumbs up to Jim Starlin.
I don't mind Death in the Family. I like Jim Starlin a lot. He did a Batman with Bernie Wrightson, who I just like adore, called The Cult.
Oh, The Cult
is amazing.
That was awesome.
Amazing,
right?
Book. Yeah.
I also liked him. I think I like him better as a writer than an artist, because he wrote that Cosmic Odyssey that Mignola drew. Yeah. That was really, really cool too, because it was doing all the Starlin stuff, but I like how Mignola draws better. So.
Yeah, I thought Starlin had a really good handle on the Cosmic Odyssey, like all of the Kirby characters' voices. Like, I thought.
He's many ways he's reinvented those characters the way we view them in the modern age.
Yeah, I absolutely love Jim Starlin. I'm delighted he's still working. He's become a little bit of a one-note guy, but it's a really good note, so I don't begrudge him for playing it. I loved his work in the 70s. I really do love those Cosmic characters. I think Jim Starlin, more than any other single creator, made me a comic book fan when I read his last issue of Captain Marvel, Captain Marvel number 34. A totally disposable throwaway book, features Nitro, a guy who blows himself up, really a dumb story, but wow, told with such energy, such visual energy, that it was the first time I, as a young reader, that I flipped to the credits page to see who did this. And then I became a fan of his work and followed it obsessively, and loved, you know, what he did with Warlock, of course, and what he's done with Thanos. You know, Marvel's going to be putting a lot of their B characters on the screen in August with Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, Marvel wouldn't have those characters if not for guys like Jim Starlin, who took them so seriously, you know, built out that whole galactic cosmos of Marvel in the 70s. And also, because we were talking about him earlier, you know, Steve Gerber, who wrote, he kind of resurrected those characters as well in the 70s. But Starlin, I think, is just tremendous and a great inspiration. I love his work.
And yeah, he's definitely he's a dream interview for me, put it that way. I mean, I'm a huge fan. And again, you mentioned that we talk about him reinventing those characters for the modern age, and say he's one note. Is there something that you like? Do you look at him and think, man, I wish he had a run on this character? Is there somebody you think, oh man, he would have been just incredible with that you never really got to see?
Oh, Starlin specifically.
Yeah. Or anybody, actually. You know,
my first reaction to that is kind of a stupid choice, but Ghost Rider on Marvel. Hmm. He did one issue of Ghost Rider, like a Race with the Devil issue or something, which was kind of, you know, a crazy 70s, you know, exploitation style story. But he, you know, Starlin had this ability to take these characters that were at the fringe of the Marvel universe and just do wonderful things with them. And I think with that kind of, you know, mystical, science fiction-y, devilish character that was still rooted in our world, which were the kind of stories he told, I think he really could have made some magic. Maybe he still will.
That's a great choice. All right. How about any books or any characters that came out in the 70s that don't play today? Dazzler? Dazzler, good one.
Was Dazzler 70s or was it 80s?
Was Dazzler 70s or 80s? Actually, I thought she was late 70s, but I could be wrong.
I would think
on
late
that.
70s. I feel like 78, 79.
Yeah, it might be. Okay. Dazzler's a good call.
She could totally work today.
Isn't she still in stuff?
Oh, yeah, totally. It's not the same.
I mean, she's not. She's not doing disco stuff or anything, but.
She's not really Dazzler, is she?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that's a good point.
1981, Mo, so you're not
all right, I'm a little
not quite.
The Nam, to me, seems like a book. Like I think The Nam is so 70s, but then you saw so many Vietnam stories in different eras being told in the 90s and stuff.
That's the best war book ever.
It's an incredible book.
After Blazing Combat is the best war comic.
Yeah, incredible book.
That is such a good book. They did it in magazines in black and white. and you can just see all Golden's art, it's crazy. And the writing's so good. They don't, like, really show anything horrible.
But the stories and the characters, the way they tell those are, that's, I mean, that's what totally sells you. Because it looks like a throwaway book. Like, just something that Marvel published to, you know, for no good reason. But the art is so good, and then the writing is just, you know, a complete match for it.
I mean, I Golden, I thought was great. You know what, I mean, we talk about Golden and Starlin and guys like this. I mean, to me, what it is about the 70s art that I love is you know how you'll watch an old movie from the 30s, and these were essentially stage actors who are now learning how to write or how to act on the screen, and you think they're overacting?
Yeah.
You know? To me, the characters drawn in the 70s are almost overacting in that they're realistic, but everything's just a slightly higher level of emotion that just seems to be put into everything. Just almost like it's overacting, but in a good way, in a way that gets across the point of the artist and the story to me.
You know, and Michael Golden was the complete package, not just in The Nom, which I know was a very personal work to him, but, you know, the first 13 issues of Micronauts, I think, are really good. And what makes them so good is not only does he take these really lame-looking toys and bring them to life, but he creates a whole universe, creates a whole world around them, and that's so critical for a science fiction book, especially, is I have to believe in that world that he's created. And even though it was kind of off-the-shelf parts and sort of a poor man's Star Wars, it was still a real fine piece of work.
Yeah, definitely. He did some cool Star Wars villains too. Speaking of that,
I think Kirby do some crazy stuff in the '70s, like crazy stuff.
Yeah.
When did Kirby stop doing crazy stuff?
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
I had a hard time with that. Like when he did Black Panther, and everything made it look like it was made out of metal. Like everything was, you know, like it was that kind of Kirby that everything just looked like it was made out of the same material, whether it was like a plant or a hand or a machine. It was just all weird Kirby stuff.
Square fingers and all.
Square fingers. You know, it's a giant galactic machine, or it's a dog.
Yeah, that late 70s Kirby return to Marvel, you know, maybe didn't work out as well as we might have hoped. And he did Black Panther, he did Eternals, he did Captain America, he did 2001.
He gave us Machine Man through 2001.
Machine Man, right? 2001.
So that's all good.
He did Devil, 2001 was beautiful.
He did Devil Dinosaur, right? The thing about those books is I was a kid reading them at the time, and I was excited because Kirby was coming back, and I was a Captain America fan, and that series started, and it was just so out of step with everything else that was being published that I'd been trained to believe was a comic book that I was dismissive of it and didn't particularly enjoy it. Reading it now as an adult looking back at it, I really love his late 70s stuff. As long as it's siloed and away from the rest of the Marvel line, it really, really works well. And he gave us Arnim Zola too in that Cap run. And that's one of the creepiest characters he's ever created. And, you know, he's in the movies now too, but there's some really, really cool stuff there. As long as if you look at it just vertically, just look at those books by themselves, even Black Panther, which is kind of goofy, they're very entertaining. But trying to fit them into the rest of the Marvel line in 75, 76, they just were square pegs.
That was kind of Kirby, though, post Marvel age, though. Like, even his DC stuff, which I think is still his strongest work, none of it really fit in. It was just wonderful, creative, individual storytelling. And I think his Marvel stuff was that same way. I think it did stand better alone. It just kind of had to play in-house a little bit.
Yeah, and he was working alone. I mean, at that point in his career, he was in California. Marvel Editorial was all out in New York. He was he pretty much had a, you know, he was doing what he wanted. And I don't think he had a lot of friends back in New York at the time, so his books maybe were a little undermined in that regard. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Kirby was always a singular guy. And I love when he tries, when he did stuff that he said, okay, this is commercial, this is mainstream, like when DC put him on Jimmy Olsen, for God's sake. What a strange pick. But he does these crazy Jimmy Olsen stories with, you know, underground empires and weird technology. And then, you know, they bring in another artist to draw Superman because Kirby Superman didn't look like he was supposed to.
Well, wasn't that just the face?
Yeah, it was just the face.
Yeah, what a strange book, though. And, you know, again, it's the 1970s. If you're a fan of 70s comics, those are all high points, I think.
Well, and it's great. I love it because it says right on the cover of, like, the Jimmy Olsen, Kirby is here. Yeah. You know, and that was like, because I remember having like, I think the first issue of Jimmy Olsen by Kirby, and like that big Kirby is here, the Forever People like coming off in the big three-wheeled motorcycle thing, and it's just like, oh my God, my mind is blown. Where the hell is Jimmy Olsen, and how does he fit into this? You
know? There's like two issues of Jimmy Olsen that guest starred Don Rickles.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about those.
Are you shitting me?
No.
They were awesome. So hilarious.
And it ties into the New Gods. You can't make this stuff up. It's great.
That's amazing. That's amazing. No, yeah. It's
so worth reading it. If anyone hasn't that's listening, it's so worth reading.
All right. So these books he did in the 70s from Marvel, none of these lasted more than a year, did they? Like these, he didn't, I mean, he comes there, you know, he's Jack Kirby and, none of them last, did they?
I think the cap run was 18, 19 issues, but that was the longest of them. Yeah, none of them last very long.
Were they meant to last, or were they all just supposed to be a short run?
No, it was a continuing assignment. I mean, I'm sure, you know, Kirby, the only reason Kirby went back to Marvel is he thought he could sell comics. And the reason Marvel brought him back is they thought he could sell comics, and they put him on books. I mean, I think that Kirby was always ahead of his time, but in this case, he really was. If he went back to Marvel in 1985 instead of 1975, when we got a direct market that's supporting a limited series format, I think Eternals would be awesome, because he'd say, I got 12 issues to tell this story. I got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And he would have blown our minds. But instead, something like Eternals had to be a continuing book. The pace is all over the place. It's in the Marvel Universe. It's not in the Marvel Universe. And as a consequence, it's, you know, it's this really sort of, I mean, it's of historical interest and has awesome concepts, but it's not a great comic. So, well,
it's sort of a like, you know, aesthetically too, it's sort of a funny period, you know, which we kind of see right now today. Like the 60s look of comics was pretty consistent. You know, there was sort of, you know, there was something of an in-house style, you know, at Marvel, which then continued through the 70s, but that in-house style was not Kirby anymore. So then he was brought back. He was brought back, but, you know, his style was effectively not what Marvel had sold for a decade. So it was just all of a sudden this anomaly coming back to a market of buyers who were, you know, who were expecting something, given something that didn't look like what they'd been told to buy for a period of time. And I think that's probably where a lot of, you know, hands went up and like, oh, this, you know, this doesn't look right.
He was also writing the books himself in the 70s when he returned to Marvel, and Jack had a very idiosyncratic style, you know, with on the nose names and a lot of puns, and you know, could be a little corny, and that also was out of step, especially on the books he did. You know, before Kirby was on Cap, it was Steve Englehart doing Captain America, and Englehart had this very kind of hyper realistic style. And before he, and the last Black Panther book before Kirby did it was Don McGregor's Black Panther, which was very, you know, poetic, kind of strange stream of consciousness book, just very different tones. And there was a cognitive dissonance. I remember it well because I was one of the kids that experienced it, going from those interpretations of the characters.
Cognitive dissonance.
Sorry.
That's good. I like that. Can that be the name of this show?
It'd be a name of a character. But I mean, it really stripped my gears mentally to go from that interpretation to these characters. Just in the course of a single issue, and it's taken me, you know, the rest of my life to appreciate what Kirby was trying to do.
Well, and it's funny too that you see that nowadays on, like, you know, DC. DC really has an in-house style, right? And, you know, when Reilly's Adventures of Superman came out with the one with you and Samney, that was sort of a, like, holy shit, does this ever not look like anything that DC is doing? Yeah. Which it's funny that you know, that sort of that
didn't the audience still tell you that, Riley?
Yeah.
You don't know how to draw Superman.
Yeah.
It's
to be fair, I drew more of a Wayne Boren Superman than a Jim Lee Superman. Because I agree with you, Scott. I don't know how to draw that Jim Lee Superman. I just Wayne Boren. I don't know.
All right, Brett, didn't we at one point, we did a show called Everybody Loves Lists, and one of the lists we created was 10 Strangest Jack Kirby Characters.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, there was some crazy characters in that.
Done some insane characters over there.
Because, well, and because
weirdest, wackiest character from Kirby from anybody else. But Brett, what were we going to say?
Well, because he also self-edited. you know? So, I mean, so he pretty much had so much control at those moments that it was just like whatever popped into his head could go on the page, and there was nobody around to say, like, Jack, that's nuts, man. It would just be like, no, whatever.
Well, that's why Olmec turned out so well, right? Like, Olmec is still, I think, his best piece of work.
Olmec rocks. Buddy Blank, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, like contextually, everything that he's trying to convey with that story is just so, it's so poignant in, like, a superhero story with a guy who has a mohawk.
A big mohawk.
A big mohawk. It's a beautiful work.
All right.
We can't forget to talk Neil Adams. You know.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Because I mean,
let's not talk. Yeah.
The thrill kill is awesome. Creepy story. Creepy collection. No. Anybody?
No.
I'm not unfortunately familiar with him, but.
I was never actually the biggest Neil Adams fan. I appreciate his work. He's. You know, he's far better at his craft than I am. Vastly better.
He'll tell you that.
Well, he will.
It's beyond true, but no, I never really... his books just... They were, like, there was just... There was no... That was... The sort of Neil Adams era was when I think the fun kind of got sucked out of comic books a little bit.
There's something to that, yeah.
And that was where I kind of, you know... That's probably why I dove into The Flash so hard in the late 70s and early 80s, because there was still a lot of fun in that book, even though it got pretty dark. But it still looked like a 60s book. It just
You're saying really when he and Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams are sitting there making Speedy a heroin addict, you consider that dark? I mean,
No, yes. It was just never my bag, man.
It's funny, because the first time I went to San Diego, Neil Adams is the very first person that I saw from a comic creator standpoint, and I just like made a beeline, and it's just like I'm looking at the table and I'm like, volume 2 of Green Lantern, Green Arrow, I'm like, I'm taking this, sign it now, you know. It's just, and that was,
you actually had, we did an interview with him, and yeah, he's interesting.
he's a crazy guy, that's for sure. I mean he was very nice to me when I was doing the interview, but I mean, we've heard like plenty of stories about him being not so nice.
Yeah. So, well, you know, but I like his art. Anyways, well, what do I say? I'm not an artist. I just look at it and I just know if I like it or not.
Sure. Well, Adams is another guy that you have to evaluate, not just for his work, but for the influence he had on the field. He's a guy that came to comics, you know, from advertising. He considered himself a failure because he had to start doing comics. It was a temporary gig. He wasn't going to stick with it. But he brought these outside ideas, not just about the way to, you know, to draw superheroes, but also just about the way to tell stories and graphic design, about the way the books are put together. And probably, you know, DC, Dick Giordano really credits him as being a guy that modernized DC and changed the way they did work. So his work can be a little, you know, he has sort of this hyper-realistic style. And it can be a little icy, maybe a little remote, sort of lack warmth. Some of his, I mean, he did one of my favorite issues.
Much like his personality.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I never met the guy. But, like, I loved, he did an issue of Avengers where, you know, Ant-Man goes into the Vision's body, he shrinks down and goes inside his body to, because some crazy-ass thing has happened to the Vision. But it's just such a wonderfully drawn and visually told story. That, you know, he's another guy I think deserves a lot of credit, regardless to what you think about his work or him as a person. He was one of the guys that changed the business for the better, I think.
I think there's so many creators too that came from him. Like, I always mispronounce this guy's name, though he's my favorite. Bill Sienkiewicz.
Sienkiewicz.
Yeah.
He wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Neil Adams, right? Like, all those early Moon Knight issues were just Neil Adams rips, right? And that's, you wouldn't get the one thing without the other. So I appreciate him for that. I like his like off brand stuff. Like his creepy stories are pretty cool.
And he's a wacky guy. I mean, again, he was great fun when I met him in San Diego. Signed my strain toasters.
Yeah. We asked him about his expanding earth theory that he's been on.
Oh, Neil Adams. Yeah.
Yeah, about he's been on the Art Bell program explaining at Coast to Coast with Art Bell, talking about the expanding Earth. He just looks at it and goes, your audience wouldn't want to hear about that, but here it is. And just goes off on this insane theory about how the Earth is getting bigger. And he's a very, very intelligent man, that's for sure. I think we do need to get out of here, Brett. I would love to keep going all night because I'm having a blast. And I hope people listening are too. But let's do it this way. You and I are going to go OUT. We'll just say comics@wetalkpodcast.com is where you can send us some feedback. So,
well, I do have one. Wait, we have to ask one question of Riley before we go.
There's always one more.
I know there's always one more. So, Riley, now this is new. So, in the curse, mm-hmm. Now you're listed as an artist, and then there's somebody else. Now, what did you like? How did the art work out in that book? Did you do all of it? Did you do some of it?
No, I only do flashbacks. I'm only doing flashbacks of the werewolf before he's captured. So he is turned into a werewolf really. Maybe I shouldn't say this. Maybe this is spoilers. Anyways, I do all this.
So in other words, just edit that whole part out, Brad.
All the werewolf just to be safe. Stuff. No, you can say this. I think it's okay. I do all the werewolf flashbacks.
All right, then. That's good to know. That answers a question from last week.
All right,
didn't have enough time to draw everything.
Riley, we'll give you a chance now to do some plugs. Then you, Scott, and then you, Paul, because Scott doesn't want to stick around and watch you plug yourself again.
Right on,
Riley.
I never said that I wouldn't. I'm just saying.
Riley, what would you like to plug?
Well, I'm doing my own book that I'm doing pretty much everything for, except I have a friend helping me with the script called Drumheller, and I'm pretty happy and excited with that, except for the covers I'm fighting right now. And Curse just came out from Boom last week, and I drew a few pages and I'm doing the covers, but it was a real collaborative process between the four of us making it. So I'm going to take some credit for the story on that too.
Yeah, why not?
And that's mostly it right now.
Scott?
January 29th sees the release of The Mysterious Strangers from Oni Press in trade form. February 12th is Downset Fight, also from Oni Press.
I think that looks fantastic. I think you should plug yourself with Downset Fight.
I appreciate that. It's my favorite book of everything I've made to date. So
I read the first digital issue that they made available, yeah. And it is tremendous, Scott. It really is. Yeah. No, Scott Kowal suck. We'll take it back on that book.
I appreciate that. It's being released. It's a 7-chapter book and released in 6 digital issues over the course of the, I think issues 1 through 3 are out, so there's 3 weeks left of digital issues leading up to the release of the physical copy. So February 12th. And you can find me talking about it on Twitter at Scott Kowalcha.
Probably here.
Yeah, I'll just be back next week.
I hope all of you are back next week. Yeah. Get rid of those other guys. You're the Great Lakes We Talk Comics hosts there.
They're the Great Lakes We Talk Comic hosts.
That's a good point.
It's a nice alternative to hearing Chris eat like chips in the background for the entire thing.
Keith is the one who's eating crunchy stuff. Chris is the one drinking beer.
Right.
Keep it straight. Keep it straight. Paul, number one. Paul, well, before you do, I'll give you a chance to plug your own thing, but quickly, you work with Appy Entertainment, iOS developer. Games for the Android phone, the iPad, that type of stuff. Anything interesting coming out there?
That's true. That is my secret identity as an app developer. We don't have anything new on the horizon. That we've pivoted the company recently to working with outside licensors. So, you know, a publisher comes to us and says, here's this cool thing, make a game out of it. So we're doing exciting stuff, but I'm under NDA and I can't say what it is.
All right. Anything for Android coming out for Nexus 5 users like myself?
You know, yes, but it's going to be towards the end of the year. And it's because we've changed from doing iOS-specific development to doing Unity-based development, and that allows us to easily move on to the Android platform. So we'll be supporting iOS and Android and consoles and Steam. We're going to be in a lot of cool places, but it's going to be awesome. Several months yet. Yeah, it's going to be a while, but it's going to be cool.
So for those people, though, who currently have an Android phone or an iPad – what should they get this Amp Entertainment then? What's the most popular? What's the thing? What's the...
Oh, they should go get Trucks and Skulls because it's loud and stupid and it's free, which is awesome. three great things.
All right, so
Smash Trucks.
I got my phone right here, man. I'm going on.
You're an Android phone.
You betcha.
Yeah, you won't find us. You won't find us on Android. You will find us on the iOS devices.
Trucks and Skulls.
Trucks and Skulls. I love Trucks.
Well, fine. Android, in that case, get up.
Android listeners, go ahead, check that stuff out. And Paul, personally.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, nothing so exciting as my illustrious colleagues tonight, but you can always find me at my blog, longboxgraveyard.com. It's well into its third year now, 125 regular installments, I think. I look at comics from the Bronze and the Silver Age. I like to say at my blog, it's always 1978. So, you know, you're going to get that perspective. And I'm also next month going to roll out an original webcomic, just a one shot with an artist friend of mine. I'm excited about that. Awesome. So hopefully it's called War Chief. It's kind of a Conan the Barbarian kind of thing. It's very short, just 9 panels. The artist is Billy King, who's a friend of mine from my video game development days. He was a concept artist at High Moon Studios, did a lot of work on the Transformers franchise for them. All the Battle for Cybertron stuff, that was his work. We're going to experiment with publishing webcomics on Instagram, actually publishing them as individual panels in our Instagram feeds, and then archiving them at the Longbox Graveyard and then trying to take it some other places. So that's, we were talking about doing comics work for love. God knows that's all it is, right? We're just doing it because we love the form. And Billy's between jobs and said he wanted to do a comic. And when a really talented artist calls you up and says, "Hey, I want to do a comic for free," the only answer is hell yes. So so we're going to do War Chief. And then, you know, if that does well, then maybe we'll do some other stuff together. But if not, then we can say we publish a comic at Longbox Graveyard, and that'll be some fun.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. All right, guys. What song are we going to tag on the end of this? Anybody got a request? Anybody?
How about The Replacements? Gary's Got a Boner.
Anybody else?
Anybody? It's a great 80s Clash type song.
Yeah, and if Gary's got a boner, it's easier for us to plug ourselves, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Nice. That's all. Good job, Paul. So anyways, we'll go out then with a song from The Clash. Bye.
See ya.
Okay.